Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of July 20th, 2012. More than 30 credit reporting companies track your financial information. Who tracks them? Well, up till now, nobody.
It's a very menacing image. It sort of gives a sense of, you know, the frightening side of money and what can go wrong when money is not used kindly and wisely.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is on the scene, and we'll hear from its director, Richard Cordray. Making the Olympic team takes more than talent and athleticism. It's also an investment.
I would like to have a consistent check. it's not all about the money, but at some point it's like glory and the honor of competing at the Olympic Games. That doesn't feed my family or pay my mortgage.
The financial sacrifice of going for the gold. Plus, the dollar bill grows wings.
We have the ability to take corrective actions and work with them to clean up problems. We have the ability to write rules that might govern how they go about their work.
Okay, so here's the sound I make whenever I have to deal with the big three credit bureaus. Although sometimes I switch it up with something like this. But seriously, folks, I'll be here all week. Try the shrimp cocktail. Anyone who has ever had to deal with an error on their credit report or even tried to figure out where all that information came from, well, they know what it's like to yearn for change. On Monday, the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau announced his agency will start overseeing Experian, Equifax, TransUnion, and more than two dozen other credit reporting agencies. Richard Cordray joins us now with more of the details. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you.
Have you ever tried to get an error expunged from your credit history?
I have not, although I have checked my credit history pretty regularly, and I urge everybody out there to do that because it's the best way to protect yourself against identity theft or mistakes that may creep into your report for any number of reasons.
Absolutely. Always a good reminder. I think I've seen the number that 40% of all credit reports have errors in them. And of course, that dispute process is completely left up to the consumer. Is that something that you plan to address?
So we have three concerns about credit reporting companies. The first is that the information that comes to them, which they don't control in the first instance, it comes from mortgage lenders, it comes from debt collectors, it comes from any number of sources, mm-hmm. may itself be inaccurate. Second, and what they do control is their process for assembling and maintaining that information. We're concerned about accuracy there. And the third thing is the point you raise, which is when you have an inaccuracy that you note in your credit report. We had a field hearing in Detroit recently where a woman stood up and told us that the credit bureaus judge her to be dead, which was facially Jeez. Refuted on the spot, that it's very difficult to get some of those things corrected. It's time-consuming and laborious for the consumer, and that doesn't feel like a right situation.
You know, for most consumers, I think the biggest frustration is not really having control over all this information, as you point out. And the control that you do have is very confusing to navigate. But how do you increase transparency when these are private companies with very proprietary databases?
So I do think that this is a problem. Most consumers are not very aware of how the credit reporting companies work. They're not aware that all of this information is being kept on them and what kind of influence it can have over their lives. For us, we now have the ability to go into these institutions, to have access to their operations, their information, and to see how things really work on the ground.
Do you see any other financial companies out there that play a larger role in our financial lives?
Well, it's interesting because this is a role that these companies play that we don't choose. We don't necessarily have the opportunity to opt in or opt
Right.
out of having our credit reports kept. I would say that the impact that the credit reporting companies now have in terms of dictating whether we can get a loan, what kind of interest rate we would pay on a loan, sometimes whether we can get hired for a job or get a certain kind of insurance policy, it's a growing influence, a significant influence. It's one that people don't know a lot about, but it's very real.
What is your goal here? Would you say this is an exercise in barking or biting? I mean, do you really have the teeth to enforce a mandate here?
So we have a number of tools. I would say our goal here is to make sure that the credit reporting market works for consumers, which is the same goal we have across other markets, the mortgage market, the credit card market, the student loan market. We want to understand the problems. We want to have a careful set of data to document what the issues are. And then we want to make sure that any practices that are harming consumers are getting cleaned up. We have, as you say, we have tools of now being able to go in and examine them on the ground to know exactly how they work. We have the tool of enforcement if that's needed at some point. We have the ability to take corrective actions and work with them to clean up problems. We have the ability to write rules that might govern how they go about their work if rules seem to be justified over time. We also have the important job of informing and educating consumers across the country about how they can protect themselves. Nobody will protect you the way you will protect yourself.
And any chance that you might get around to Fair Isaac and the credit score? I have always wondered who died and made FICO the king of our finances.
I think they've had an effective business model over the years. First of all, the credit scoring is based on the information that's in your credit report. That's why checking the credit report is so important and making sure that any inaccuracies are corrected. The credit scoring models are a bit of a black box. We will be able to know more about that as we go. Credit scores can differ from one provider to another. I know that's very, very confusing to consumers, and it's something that we would like to render more transparent.
All right. Richard Cordray, Director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Tess.
So here's one thing the credit reporting agencies could care less about. Your savings, even if you have 100 million bajillion bucks in the bank, doesn't matter. But if you do, good on you. Maybe you're German. The European debt crisis has beaten up the likes of Greece, Spain, and Portugal. But Germany, well, they boast low unemployment and an 11% savings rate. Ours, by the way, is around 4%. Caitlin Carroll has more from Berlin.
Most countries have different words for debt and guilt. Not Germany.
The German word for debt is Schulden. And yeah, I feel guilty is ich fühle mich schuldig.
Berliner Stefan Schmidt is giving me a vocabulary lesson at a local beer garden. He pays for his pint in cash and hardly ever uses his credit card for daily purchases.
It just doesn't make sense, like all the interest you have to pay.
To understand this caution, you need to look at Germany's history, says Karl Ludwig Holtfrerisch, who's a retired professor of economics at the Free University in Berlin.
In countries like Italy, Spain, Portugal, credit played a huge role to finance commerce. In Germany, that never happened. You know, Germany was a poor country until the last third of the 19th century.
He says some European countries are just more comfortable with credit. Take Italy. It built cities like Venice and Genoa through borrowing. But Germany's had some tough experiences with credit. During World War I and II, citizens lent money to the government in the form of war bonds. And then the currency lost its value, a disaster for the lenders.
Hyperinflation wiped out all those debts of the government. Or looked at it from the other side, the credits and savings of the citizens.
And three generations later, that fear of inflation and debt still lingers. At their home in Berlin, journalist Heike Vohwinkel and her husband watch over their two sons. Vohwinkel looks on and reflects on her own childhood.
I'm afraid I was quite... stingy or...
as a child?
Yeah, as a child.
Vohwinkel says her parents and grandparents tried to save wherever they could, so she wore hand-me-downs from her sister. And as a teenager, she worked at a local factory to save money for driving lessons. Now that her oldest boy is six, Vohwinkel wants to pass on some of that thrift.
I tried to tell him that things cost money, and that he has to care after his things, because if they are destroyed, I can't buy them just like this.
Germany's banks are in on this game, too. Every year around October, the country celebrates World Savings Day. Children bring their savings to the bank and get toys or balloons in return. There's face painting and games. It's good to encourage saving, but Karl Ludwig Holtfrerisch says there are sometimes unintended consequences from Germany saving too much.
If the Germans don't consume but save, somebody has to put that credit or capital to use.
Somebody, like those other Eurozone countries now in trouble for buying too much on credit. Germany's Olympian savings skills made all that runaway credit available in the first place. German frugality and Greek-style free spending both have their place in the global economy, but Team Europe needs to find a balance if it's to compete effectively. In Berlin, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Who doesn't love a lemonade stand, right? I mean, it's kids, plus a tart and sweet drink on a hot day, plus watching them figure out how to make change for a dollar. That's all priceless. Until, that is, some of us nosy adults butt in with ridiculous questions. Here's commentator Helene Olin.
My son Jake runs a lemonade stand. He's good at it, adding items like popcorn and cookies to boost the take. Once, when pedestrian traffic was slow on our suburban cul-de-sac, he even set up a drive-through option. He earns anywhere between $20 and $35 for a few hours of work, and he puts the money toward everything from Chinese takeout to saving up for concert tickets. I'm proud of my budding entrepreneur, but some of Jake's patrons are dissatisfied, and not with the quality of his lemonade. They want him to donate his sales proceeds to charity. Many ask what cause their money is going to as they pay their tab, and are shocked when they hear it's his own bank account. They argue with me, Jake says. They keep asking me to give the money to charity. What's going on? Lemonade stands are an iconic American childhood pastime. I had one. You probably had one. But here's the thing. We almost always kept the money for ourselves. If you're wondering, I bought hit singles at the local Sam Goody record store. Philanthropic lemonade stands are admirable, but they shouldn't be the default for our kids' summer fun. Lemonade stands teach our children valuable lessons on how to run a small business. An activity as classically American as, well, the lemonade stand. To expect more than that seems as joyless and humorless as much else in modern parenting, where everything, it seems, needs to be for some greater goal. Let me be clear. Jake is not uncharitable. He raises money every year for a friend with cystic fibrosis. But when he runs a lemonade stand, his goal is supplementing his allowance, not improving the world. And I'm okay with that.
Helene Olin is an essayist and author of the upcoming book Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. It takes hard work and talent to become an Olympic athlete. Also, the ability to bankroll your own training.
Most people, you know, have jobs. If they're lucky enough to have sponsorships, then, you know, that kind of supplements their income. This year, I work two coaching jobs, you know, and I'm also an actor, so I do little side things here and there.
The cost of going for gold or even just making the team. Next on Marketplace Money from APM. You guys have heard about this yet, but the Olympics kick off on Friday. Now, we all know the games are about competition, athletic achievement, adversity overcome, life goals attained. But it's also about whether you'll capture enough attention to turn gold medals into gold coin, or at least enough coin to defray the upfront costs of all that effort. Last month, I visited the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Chula Vista, California. It's a sprawling 150-acre campus just north of the Mexico border, with facilities for BMX biking, archery, field hockey, rowing, and track and field. Including, of course, the high jump, where Jamie Nieto was practicing with the bar set at 6 feet 9 inches. It was the week before he headed to Oregon for the Olympic track and field trials. We sat down with him trackside to talk about what kind of financial sacrifices he's had to make as an Olympic hopeful.
Jamie Nieto, thanks for meeting us out here at the track.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us how long you've been having this Olympic dream of yours?
Oh, it's been at least 8 years now. The last time I made the Olympics was in 2004, and I just missed out on the Olympic team in 2008, and so missing out kind of made my dream even more prevalent and wanting to achieve it, you know. So, you know, this year is going to be a great year, especially when I, and if I achieve it, God willing.
How does an amateur athlete support himself when you are going for the gold?
That's the biggest misconception amongst the public. Track and field athletes are not amateurs anymore. We haven't been amateurs since 1980s, probably, or 70. I'm not really even sure. We make money. It's just depending on how much money we make. It all depends on sponsorship. It depends on your ranking. It depends on how well you're doing that year. You know, if you're winning a lot of meets, you have the potential to make a lot of money. But if not, then not, you know. So most people have jobs. If they're, you know, lucky enough to have sponsorships, then, you know, that kind of supplements their income. This year, I work two coaching jobs, you know, and I'm also an actor, so I do little side things here and there.
How does the whole sponsorship element of all this come in? I mean, do you have to be at a certain level? The fact that you got fourth back in 2004, did that do something for you?
Yeah. I was sponsored in 2003 to 2008 by Nike, and they gave me a very, very small annual stipend. And
what's small?
I guess I'm not sponsored by them anymore, so it really doesn't matter. $15,000 for the year, which is not to down Nike in any way, because I thought they helped me as best as they could. But I think it's almost a slap in the face, because if you think about it, the average American makes $36,000 a year. So I'm making poverty level money, and I'm a professional athlete representing the United States. But, you know, speaking more on the whole amateur thing, they don't even pay you to go to the Olympic Games. We go to the Olympic Games for free. It's another slap in the face. You know, there is the USOC who does pay us if we place in the top three. First place, I believe, is 50,000. Second is 20, and third is 10. You know, I think if you asked John Elway to go to the Super Bowl and we're not going to pay you, I think he'd be pretty upset. We could ask Derek Jeter to go to the World Series, and won't you just do it for free? Do it for the love and the honor of your country. Dwayne Wade came up with a comment the other day saying, I think NBA Olympians should be paid. And then he retracted the statement and said, I think all Olympians should be paid. I agree. I totally agree. All Olympians should be paid. And the Olympics are the most widely watched sport in the world during Olympic time, you know, especially track and field. So why wouldn't we be able to profit some from that? I don't see why not.
What does it cost you to pursue your dream of going to the Olympics?
Blood, sweat, and tears. And it also cost me money to live, because I got to supplement my income somehow to pay my mortgage for the year and to be able to eat, and paying for tennis shoes and training gear. Since I train here, I'm very fortunate, so I'm not incurring a cost here. But traveling, maybe $3,000, $5,000, something like that, you know, nothing too bad, you know, but that's compounded on towards the mortgage and the food and whatever else I'm spending money on to continue to train and compete.
What kind of financial sacrifice do you make to be an Olympic hopeful?
Well, the financial sacrifice I make is I live pretty cheaply. I don't splurge on anything. I don't do a lot of clothes shopping, you know, try to make my meals or eat here, or I try to live as cheap as possible so I can save my money so I can be able to afford to do this. So it's tough, but it's a sacrifice. I mean, with everything that you want to do in life, I think, you know, you got to have a sacrifice in one way or another, you know, to be the best at it. So a financial sacrifice, this is only a small portion of my life that I'm actually going to be doing this. You know, I probably will compete the rest of this year, maybe next year, if I'm able to afford it, you know. But I was actually planning on retiring this year.
How old are you?
I'm 35.
35.
Mm-hmm. You know, I probably have a couple more years in me to compete if I would like, but I would like to have a consistent check. You know, it's not all about the money, but at some point it's like glory and the honor of competing at the Olympic Games that doesn't feed my family, or, you know, that doesn't pay my mortgage, you know. So at some point it's like you need to get a real job to kind of do that. Even though I'm not really going to get a real job, I plan to be an actor, you know. I will probably coach for a little while until acting really takes off for me. But I've been fortunate, like I said, to have been able to find another passion. But not everybody finds that. And you find athletes lingering into the sport well past the time that they should be gone.
What's the most you've ever made in a year?
Probably around 100,000.
Really?
Yeah. but that's 1 or 2 years.
Right.
Not these last couple of years.
Well, it's not something that you can count on from year to year. You don't know what you're going to make from year to year.
Exactly. And what I was going to say is there's two different levels to this. You know, you can be in that top tier. You win the Olympics. You win a lot of meets and stuff like that. You can make $1 million. I can make $1 million in a year. The likelihood of that happening is really tough. The chances of that is real. I mean, we're talking about the best competition in the world. So it's not very easy to do that, but it's possible. It is definitely possible, yeah.
All right. Jamie, thank you so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So how'd he do at the trials? Well, at the ripe age of 35, he became the oldest man to qualify for the Olympic high jump team, clearing 7 feet, 5 3/4 inches, first place. So keep an eye out for him when the track and field events begin on August 3rd. Now, obviously, Jamie would love to come out of these games with a gold medal and some lucrative contracts. Basically, every athlete there would love to be the next Bruce Jenner, Mary Lou Retton, and, you know, that swimmer guy.
Michael Phelps fuels up with the mega tasty Subway Turkey Melt, a protein-packed powerhouse on freshly baked bread, so he can get to where the action is this winter.
You don't have to be a gold medal winner to be a champion. It starts with one simple act every day. And for me, that's my multivitamin from GNC.
I put in a lot of years and put away a lot of Wheaties, because a complete breakfast with Wheaties is good tasting and good for you.
Take it from Bruce Jenner. Wheaties is the breakfast of champions.
But sports agent Evan Morgenstein says winning gold is just one step in securing an endorsement deal. And even that is not always a guarantee. He is CEO of PMG Sports, which represents hundreds of athletes, including 9 current Olympians. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Is it possible to know ahead of time who is going to end up being able to reap something out of this?
Not usually. I mean, not to the passive follower. You know, my business is representing Olympic athletes. I recruit talent. I can see talent. And I usually recruit people based on their stories. So somebody that has a really interesting story, a compelling story, hopefully they're going to have performance at the Olympic Games, and then that becomes really the total package.
Is there any way to just kind of generalize what a successful Olympic athlete can make following their performance?
I think the difference is two things. Number one, I think it's based on the sport that they're in. So if you're in one of the big sports, let's say swimming, track and field, or gymnastics, mm-hmm. and you hit big like Nastia Lukin did in 2008, you are much more likely to have not only significant deals offered to you, but to have longevity. Hmm. And Nastia has 9 or 10 sponsors that she's had for the last 4 years. That's almost unheard of. But as an example, if you are the Olympic gold medalist in table tennis, you unfortunately, unless you know you're got some crazy story that nobody's ever heard of before, you're going to probably be focused on the endemics, the paddle companies, the apparel companies, things like that. And then the subset of that, unfortunately, is let's say you win your gold medal in swimming the day that Ryan Lochte and Michael Phelps battle to a world record and they both get it. They tie for the world record. I promise you, your gold medal will never be merchandised because nobody will ever hear about it.
So when you're talking to some of these athletes about trying to capitalize on this experience, what is your advice to them in terms of how they might make themselves more valuable once it's all over with? Aside from, of course, winning a gold medal.
Right. You know, look, that's what everybody wants, but unfortunately not everybody's going to win a gold medal.
Right.
And I've had plenty of non-gold medalists make money as well. But I start off by telling people, don't drunk tweet. Everybody's watching.
You really need to tell them that?
Oh, absolutely. These are kids. They're kids, you know, because most of their friends aren't athletes. You know, you have to pay attention to that. Social media, basically what it does is it exposes the athlete to a significant audience, which is great on a very immediate basis and in a very intimate way. The flip side of that is if you don't have your best day in life, which could mean anything, somebody's going to take a picture of it and tweet it, and all of a sudden it's going to be everywhere. So, you know, I share that with people first and foremost, but I also tell people in terms of making themselves more marketable, instead of saying, how much money am I going to make? You know, you need to answer questions for me such as, are you a good public speaker? Do you have any idea how you want to communicate your story? Do you know exactly why people would even be interested in you? Do you know the history of your sport? These are things that seem so basic, but if someone doesn't say it, nobody's going to pay attention to it.
When you talk to athletes who are on their way to the Olympics, obviously the games are all about personal accomplishment. But I think for a lot of them, it's also, you know, hopefully I'm the one who ends up on the Wheaties box or, you know, something similar.
Sure.
But that is really a very, very, very small number of people.
Well, actually, that's not true.
No?
No, it's not true. So what happens is, whether it's Wheaties or Kellogg's or any company non-cereal oriented, most of these companies have made all of their deals prior to the Olympics, and they're ready if one of the people that they've signed hits and hits big. So those deals are all done prior to the Olympics.
Before any medals are handed out?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because they need to be prepared. They have to have artwork done, legal approval. The decision on who actually is going to get the Wheaties box is not made until after the Olympics.
Huh. So these athletes have an idea of what kind of bank they might get.
Well, I mean, that's just one deal. You know, I mean, there's no – I tell people I've never been involved with an athlete where they did one deal where they're ready to retire.
Yeah.
Nor was I with my small percentage of what I make from that deal. You know, it's a volume business. We are in a volume business. Unfortunately, the financial system of the Olympics is just a mess. There is truly no trickle-down of any substance for the athletes. The IOC splits billions of dollars, but the athletes get the shaft, and that's an unfortunate reality.
Hmm. Evan Morgenstein is CEO of PMG Sports. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. It was nice speaking with you.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
As we speak, the Olympic torch is zigzagging its way around London. The torch is powered, by the way, by natural gas, this country's latest favorite energy source. It is now so cheap that people with electric stoves are mulling a switch. And it just so happens one of our reporters is in the market for a new kitchen range. So here's Marketplace's Scott Tong doing some of the math for himself and for the rest of us.
We own a legacy model electric kitchen range. Allow me to demonstrate. I fill the kettle, put it on the stove, and then I count how many things I can do before the water boils. I empty the dryer. I fold a load. I put away the clothes.
Daniels.
I jump in the driveway hockey game with my sons Evan and Daniel. I mow that strip of grass I missed last week. I come back in, cut the watermelon, start tomorrow's coffee.
Okay, how many minutes was that?
11 minutes.
That's my daughter Audrey, by the way. It's time to replace the old range, but with gas or electric. My wife Kathy and I both like gas cooking. It's fast and it's super hot. And as an energy reporter, I hear America's full of cheap natural gas. The question is, are we sure it's going to stay cheap?
I think that's probably a reasonable assumption.
That's Jeff Harris at the nonprofit Alliance to Save Energy. It is warned, though, whatever the fuel, it's not free.
It's not going to be, as we once said about nuclear power, too cheap to meter, whether it's electricity from natural gas or from other fuels or even renewable energy. All of those cost money and all of them can be important to use efficiently.
So let's do a bit of math to compare fuel costs. My gas bill says we pay 50 cents per therm. Our electricity costs 10 cents per kilowatt hour. I'm stumped. It's hard to do apples to apples here. So I call this guy.
My name is Michael Bluejay. I run a website called Saving Electricity at michaelbluejay.com.
Michael Bluejay does a lot of home energy math.
You're paying 50-something cents, so you're paying half of what the national average is. So, yeah, your gas is very cheap.
And our electricity is kind of average price. So in 1 year, gas cooking would set us back $65 in fuel. Electricity, $250. Yay, gas. Except our gas pipes, they don't connect from the basement all the way up to the kitchen. So I bring in the plumber.
Typically, we try to stay in the back.
We're talking $1,200 to do that work. And the projected gas savings versus electric could make that money back in maybe 7 years. Of course, there are other considerations. Michael Bluejay, for instance, he doesn't have gas in his house because...
You know, if you have gas lines in your home is that much more likely to blow up from a gas line leak. And I was surprised when I read the manual for a gas range, and it warned that if you use that in your home, it could kill any pet birds that you might have.
The canary is always the first to go. Still, we vote gas. And as a general rule, Bluejay says gas appliances do save on energy costs. Thing is, the big difference is not in kitchen ranges. Again, Jeff Harris at the Alliance to Save Energy.
Something that you might pay more attention to, use of natural gas or electricity in a furnace or heat pump. That's the single biggest energy use in most homes. Or for hot water, which is often the second biggest use.
And on the topic of hot water, here's a money-saving tip. Wash your clothes in cold. Michael Bluejay says they get clean just fine. And his family does cold every single day. Well, almost.
On rare occasion, if we have something that's very soiled, we might use warm, but it's special. It's like, you know, the Christmas of washing clothes. It's a special day when we do that.
He says cold washing can save $100 a year. Want more energy tips?
Using ceiling fans and then turning off your air conditioner, $400. Turning off unused lights. I figure if you turn off 5 lights, that's about $300 a year.
Now we're saving real money, even if you're not in the market for a new appliance. If you are, like us, think about a cheaper fuel. In our case, it could save money and time. For more hockey in Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Up, it is a crime to deface dollar bills, but folding them up into insects? Well, that's just good fun.
You see George Washington's face on the back of each wing. He also folded the head so that you see the words "In God We Trust" across the forehead of each of the locusts.
An art installation of Money Origami, later on Marketplace Money, from APM. Often have we said it. Pretend your retirement account is swarming with killer bees or maybe rabid bats and do not touch it. But for all kinds of reasons, fingers are going back into that sacred pot. David Lazarus is here to bemoan this with us. He of the Los Angeles Times. Good to see you.
Likewise, I'm sure.
How's your retirement fund going?
Well, okay, but then again, I treat it like this sacrosanct little thing that needs to be nurtured and stroked and petted, and in no way do I ever try to expose it to danger.
Well, I would hope not, but that apparently is what a lot of people are doing these days. In your very publication, I saw an article recently that said people are day trading in their 401ks. Oh,
I know.
Please, no, God.
And everybody at home should see, you know, Tess and mine's head spinning around as she says that. And yet, you kind of got to kind of think about the circumstances that would prompt that. And we've just come out of this ugly recession. There have been a series of bear markets.
Sure.
And there are people in their 50s and their 60s right now approaching the finish line who have watched their retirement funds, whether it's a 401k or a pension or whatever, getting hammered. And now they're thinking, what do I do to catch up? And I think that's the impetus behind some of this day trading nonsense. It's this idea of, okay, maybe I better roll the dice a little bit if I want to get to where I want to be.
But you know, can't we just be a little patient and not take these massive risks?
Yeah. On the other hand, I think as the clock starts ticking down, I do understand the concern among people. Here's some interesting numbers. The average 60-year-old has only $114,500 in his or her 401k at the moment. And get this, half have less than $37,000 at the moment. Americans are a collective $6.6 trillion short of the amount that they need to retire comfortably, and that's according to the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College.
But how on earth is day trading going to get you to where you have to be? And you trade that off with how much risk you're taking.
Exactly. And for everybody playing along at home, day trading is you're essentially taking your stocks, whether it's a mutual fund or an individual stock, and you are playing the market daily, going in and out of different positions, mm-hmm. hoping to arbitrage that into some sort of winning. But the vast majority of people, whether it's at Vegas or whether it's day trading, will get hammered. And that's because you can't predict how the market's going to go. You can't predict what stocks are going to do. You are literally gambling. And the odds are typically going to be against you.
We also heard this very week that an enormous number of people are now borrowing from their 401ks. However, what is happening now is that these folks who took out these loans are not able to pay them back. And we now have a 17% default rate on loans being taken out from 401ks. And that is almost double what it was back in 2008. That has got to be a red flag.
Exactly. And it is a huge red flag, but it is also a big sign of the times because the driver here isn't greed.
No.
It isn't this desire to run off to Tahiti. No, what's happening here is we've got this unemployment rate that just won't come down. You've got a lot of people, a lot of families who are either living paycheck to paycheck or no paycheck at all. And this is the one pot of money they can get their hands on. So I get it.
You know,
I understand what's happening. There's a couple of takeaways here. The first one would be, if you can, just don't.
Right.
Because this is not the money you want to touch. But if you do got to touch it, put the money back.
You know, I wonder if both of these things that we've been talking about with the 401k system point to a real flaw, particularly when you think about us as, you know, we're just human beings and we think of that now as our money. And it's very different from a pension system where that was just it was locked away. You didn't have access to it. But now we have this pot of money sitting there in our 401ks and we're allowed to mess with it.
I think there's something to what you're saying. And every time I hear conservative champions of the idea of privatizing Social Security or other vehicles like this, I think, you know, that's good on paper. It's good in theory. But in reality, human nature being what it is, sometimes you can't resist the temptation.
Right.
Sometimes you have no choice. I agree with you. When it's beyond your reach or when it's hard to get at,
right,
chances are you're not going to mess with it. I think another element to this is that Americans particularly are very short-sighted. We are very big on instant gratification. It's one of our more endearing qualities. And that sort of prevents us from taking in the longer view. And when it comes to retirement planning, the longer view is everything.
All right. Thanks, David.
My pleasure.
And speaking of work and the 401k that we get out of work, well, on next week's show, we'll be discussing the meaning of hard work. And we'd like to know what you think when you hear that phrase. Tweet us, post on Facebook, or write to us at marketplace.org. On a trip back home to see my parents last year, my mom asked me to go through a bunch of stuff in their catch-all room. She had my prom dresses, piano recital programs from when I was like six, photos, ribbons, no Olympic medals, unfortunately, but all the other detritus of childhood. Of course, they've also got my brother's stuff, and they've got their stuff. Now, if and when they ever move, they'll probably downsize, as many people do, even after 20-plus years in the same place. That is often a tough, time-consuming, and expensive business. But as Laurie Stern reports, help is available.
I'm just trying to clean off enough space for us to be able to eat some takeout.
The table where Bruce Johnson and his wife hosted birthday parties and Passover seders is overflowing with books and knickknacks destined for the garage sale this weekend.
My name is Luann, and my husband, Bruce Johnson, and I are moving from our house in Minneapolis, where we have lived for 25 years.
Bruce was laid off a few years ago.
Nobody hires you when you're 64. So what do we do to start over?
Last summer, the Johnsons bought a bigger, cheaper house in the country that needs fixing up, a perfect project for Bruce. They knew they'd have to sell the Minneapolis house eventually. But early on, they got a great offer from a developer. They had 7 weeks to get out, and they were overwhelmed.
It's like with the stuff, you know.
Oh, I remember when we used to keep brown sugar in this jar. I feel nostalgic about that. I mean, you know, what the hell? Where do you draw the line with physical objects and memories?
Unloading 25 years of stuff, deciding what to keep and what to toss, can be emotionally excruciating and incredibly time-consuming. It can be financially draining, too. Lucky for the Johnsons, they live in Minneapolis, where they learned about a new company called Empty the Nest.
I'm Sharon Fishman. I am here today looking through this house to figure out how we're going to empty it.
And I am Chris Yan. I am Sharon's partner. And we've got to go through with the family to decide what we will be taking and what the family will be taking. What is trash and what can be recycled back into the community or repurposed.
Empty the Nest will dispose of a house full of junk for next to nothing. Clients pay only for the cost of hazardous waste disposal and a dumpster for trash. Empty the Nest recycles everything it can.
Metal, we work with metal scrappers. The clothing goes to Goodwill. Unopened food goes to the food shelf. Mm-hmm. As little into the landfill as possible. The client gets all donation receipts forwarded on to them.
Once Lou and Bruce found Empty the Nest, they felt better about parting with their things. Until the closing date got closer.
Oh my God, here's the whole dresser.
Luann had asked her two grown daughters to take what they wanted, but they'd left some valuables?
Full of what? What? What is this? Beanie Babies! Yay! Those can be worth so much, remember? Beanie Babies were an investment.
So what stuff in the basement?
Okay, here's the scary stuff. This isn't scary.
No, we love this.
Scared of it.
We love this.
A week and a half before closing, Luann has a basement top to bottom full of furniture and rows of dusty bookshelves crammed with boxes.
It was my ventriloquist doll.
It's your ventriloquist doll. Oh, yeah.
And my kids always thought it was scary, so nobody ever played with it.
Oh, that's too bad.
You may be wondering how a company can make money from other people's cast-offs. Well, not all of the client's stuff goes to charity or the scrapyard. Fishman and Yan cherry-pick the good stuff and sell it.
We have a once-a-month sale, and we try and have a theme each time we do it. Our themes in the past have been things like tools, vintage clothing, mm-hmm. jewelry.
People do actually line up to get in for our monthly sales. Mm-hmm. We have to hand out numbers. It's fun.
The Johnson's Ethan Allen desk will sell, and the ventriloquist doll, and Lou's pink frilly dress from the 80s.
What
that
kind
is
of hideous.
Fabulous.
Look at this.
We
it's
love
the ugliest
that.
Dress I've ever saw.
We do.
I know. Okay. We're crazy girls like
you. We've actually had clients in tears joy when we're done. A lot of thank yous.
And we've had families come in who buy these, you know, beautiful couches for really inexpensive, and they have like 6 children, and they would never have what they have if it weren't for the pricing that we afforded at.
For now, Fishman and Yan have one employee and Yan's husband to help with the hauling. They have not had a day off since they started their company about a year ago. They do most of the work themselves.
That is why we are in shape.
Yes, yes, we do get dirty.
Oh, yes.
When they started, Fishman and Yan served 2 families a month. Now they're up to 3 or 4 a week. Empty the Nest has been so profitable that now the women want to replicate it in other cities.
We have trademarked our name nationwide, mm-hmm. and our goal is to franchise.
The company's promise to empty a house of years of junk for free seems like it would be a winner. The trick will be getting clients like Luann Johnson and her family to part with their treasures.
This says keep, Ellie, keep. Keep. Keep!
In Minneapolis, I'm Laurie Stern for Marketplace.
Disco for you on Marketplace Money from APM. The dollar bill is the most common denomination of U.S. banknote, and you probably don't give it a second thought, other than it's a means to pay your bills or buy something. So when I heard there is an origami exhibit made entirely of dollar bills, well, I had to go see that for myself. Well, we're here at the Japanese American National Museum in Little Tokyo in downtown Los Angeles, and I'm with Mayor MacArthur, who is an art historian and an independent curator. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tess. So glad you could come.
Describe for us what we are looking at here that starts on the floor and ends in the air.
Well, we're looking at an origami installation piece, and it is made up of 144 origami locusts folded out of U.S. dollar bills.
And these are sheets of dollar bills.
That's right. Each locust is made of a sheet of uncut dollar bills, and in each square, there are 21 U.S. dollars.
What is this all supposed to mean? Why locusts?
Why locusts? Yes, well, the artist Sipho Mabona, he's a Swiss-South African artist, he has heard a lot of politicians in Europe talking about locusts or Heuschrecken, and this term refers to the large multinational corporations who are going around the world gobbling up the smaller companies and spitting them out for quick profit. And these Heuschrecken are very unpopular in Europe, apparently. And when he heard this on the news, he thought, well, wouldn't it be amazing to create a plague of locusts out of money? And the U.S. dollar bill is obviously a symbol worldwide of capitalism. So it made sense to create these locusts out of dollar bills.
Why not the British pound?
Too expensive.
Really? Is that simple?
The dollar was a cheaper currency, and he had to buy a lot of them.
The euro, perhaps?
Even more valuable. So, yes, I suggested the rupees, but they're not as symbolic a currency internationally.
Well, so we're looking at these sheets of currency. How does one go about getting those? Do you have to go to the Fed, go to the mint?
For dollar bills, you actually go to the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing. Uh-huh. And Sipho lives in Switzerland, and he wasn't able to ask them to send the bills to him. He had to actually fly out to New York to pick them up and then fly back home and then fold them and then come back out here with them again.
Did he have to tell them what he was doing?
I believe he told them that he was using them for an art project. And he is not alone. Apparently, artists buy sheets of dollar bills all the time. And interestingly, a sheet of uncut U.S. dollar bills costs more than the
actual
value
currency
of each of the bills in the sheet.
There is a lot of detail with each of these insects. Describe how each of them is actually made.
He uses water, and this is a technique called wet folding that a lot of origami artists use these days. It helps you to model the form. I saw him using clamps to hold the wings in place because he twisted them around so that you see George Washington's face on the back of each wing. He also folded the head so that you see the words, "In God We Trust," across the forehead of each of the locusts.
I don't know how I feel about dollar bills turning into locusts.
Well, it's a very menacing image.
It is.
It really gives a sense of, you know, the sort of frightening side of money and what can go wrong when money is not used kindly and wisely. But one of the things that I love about this piece is that in origami, you have a sense of hope, because with every square of paper that you fold into something, be it a locust or a hornet or any other kind of creature, you can unfold it again and then refold it into something else. So in theory, all of these locusts could be unfolded and then refolded into butterflies. So you have a lovely, delightful swarm of butterflies in the gallery instead. But we won't be doing that, obviously,
right?
Because there's a lot of work involved. But there is this idea of hope that he wants to convey with the piece as well.
Mayor MacArthur, joining us at the Japanese American National Museum here in Little Tokyo. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for coming.
And we have pictures and a video of the installation at marketplace.org. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to, Honolulu. Oh, to be a pig. Well, he's on his way to Carol Whitney's house. She wrote to us about the best financial advice she ever got from a dad. Now, not her dad. Ross and Monica's dad on Friends. Here with the clip she says has guided her from the moment she saw it on season 2 in 1996.
I'm no longer at my job. I had to leave it.
Why?
Because they made me.
You were fired? What are you going to do?
Judy, relax. This is our little harmonica we're talking about. We taught her well. 10% of your paycheck. Where does it go?
In the bank.
The bank.
There you go. So she dips into her savings. That's what it's there for. She's going to be fine. Aren't you, sweetie?
In the bank.
Thanks to Jack Geller, and apparently no thanks to Monica. Carol says she is financially secure and sees a bright future ahead of herself. Because of this, Piggy approves of all sitcom references to savings. And he looks forward to his trip to the islands. If you have a pop culture money moment that we might like, we'd love to know about it. Boing, boing. Boing, boing. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Tess Vigeland. Next time, hard work as part of our national identity.
Certainly immigrants are among the hardest workers. They get the ethic from coming from a country where you don't have a big, fat government safety net. You either work or you don't have food.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.